Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Oh, boy. Well, so, you know, there's something that you really should do when you start a radio program, and that is to take your mute, your microphone off of mute. So, we're starting over here. Good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly vigorous, relentless, and sometimes ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the very well-armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. It's my pleasure to speak with the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. With a face for radio and a voice for silent movies, when I remember to take my microphone off of mute, my name is Nick Clark. I'm the president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well-Armed Radio, and encourage you to be a part of the show with your calls, ideas, questions, comments, criticism, participation. 563-999-3787 is the studio number here, 563-999-3787. Start the show with the usual warning, no sacred cows here. And damn it, I had, what did I go for there? I mean, I think I was going for, how long was I going for without, with my microphone on mute? And then all of a sudden I'm hitting here, seeing people say, I can't hear your broadcast, no audio. So, yeah, I was, well, it's 119. That was, gosh, that was almost, well, the intro is 3 minutes. So that was probably a good 5 minutes, that I blew there. But anyway, I'll try to remember everything I said there during that, time that my microphone was on mute. Right back to regular shows now. Kevin from the Kenosha County Eye joined us for the last 3 weeks for the coverage of the Rittenhouse case. Still going to be talking about the Rittenhouse case tonight. There's some more things to talk about, but really enjoyed having Kevin on and hope you guys enjoyed his, yeah, Scott says about 8 minutes. That was the best 8 minutes of the show. So I hope you guys enjoyed having Kevin on, and hope I can do a good show tonight when we're back to our kind of our normal format here. But hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving. You know, Thanksgiving is just my absolute favorite time of year. When I say Thanksgiving, fall is my favorite time of year. Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday. I love that it always falls on a Thursday. It's just, you know, food and chilling out and no big commitments and things to go do and gifts and just, you know, it's just Thanksgiving, which is nice. And it always falls on a Thursday, so it doesn't mess up your week too much. You know, Monday turns into Wednesday, so the whole week is kind of an easy week. Tuesday is like a Thursday and Wednesday is like a Friday, that Thanksgiving weekend. And then of course you got that night. I don't go out on Wednesday, but Wednesday before Thanksgiving, that's what they consider usually like the second biggest party night of the year, I guess, behind New Year's. But everybody's heading home and nothing to do on Thursday but eat turkey and sleep in. So that's why it turns into a big party night. But yeah, I love Thanksgiving. I love fall. My favorite time of year. I mean, I like winter. I like summer. I like spring. But I hate the below zero crap. I mean, you can save that. There's nothing enjoyable. I can't think of anything, any reason to enjoy that weather. But, you know, fall is kind of like cooler weather, so I like the smell of the air in the fall. I like the dry air, no bugs. The colors of leaves in the trees are great. That's a real pretty scene. But you know, you're not, again, it's not too hot. You're not sweating. It smells different. It smells different in the fall than it does in the summer. And I don't know, something is just a little more cozy about fall. And fall is kind of like, you know, we generally don't get too much snow here, and I'm just not a big fan of snow anymore. You know, when I was a kid, I loved snow, and now I could do without it. Just nothing good comes from snow. I mean, really, let's be honest. Yeah, here even says no sunburn. Yeah, that's one thing, and I don't know. I hate when the sun goes down so early. You know, that's one of the bummers of fall. But it's another thing that makes fall a little bit more low key. I mean, for me, summer is so busy. Business is really, really busy during summer, and fall things start to slow down a little bit for me. And so I can kind of just enjoy things a little bit more. Summer is pretty stressful. Just, you know, we take the yacht out every Saturday, but then that's, it's stress. I gotta clean it once a week. And so it's not stressful, but then in the fall, all we do is hike with the dog. So that's, and you don't have to watch. Oh, that's another thing. In the summer, I got to watch the weather. You know, is it going to rain on Saturday? Am I going to be able to get the boat out? Am I going to have, you know, just watching the wind and wave forecasts? Am I going to be able to go somewhere? But like fall, you know, yeah, we could get rain, but, you know, I generally fall just tends to be a little bit of a drier season. And so I don't have to sit there and hover over the weather for my fun activities during the weekend. So it's just weekend comes. If it's sunny and nice, we hike. If it's overcast and gray, we hike with the dog. If it's kind of crappy weather, but not heavy, heavy rain, we hike with the dog. So, you know, it's just, I don't know, it's a less stressful time of year. Fall's just my favorite time of year. And that said, when spring comes, you know, that's exciting too. You really enjoy the coming of warmer weather. You know, it's all out in front of you, spring and outdoor stuff and fun activities I like in the summer. But yeah, winter is okay because now that we have the dog to go hiking with, but just that below zero crap is the only thing I have no use for that. Below zero, nah. Snow, it's a pain in the ass to shovel. You know, if we're going to get snow, I like big, just dump on us with a big storm and then, you know, have some nice 20 degree high, upper 20s, you know, not that big melting crap. And just, so we got snow on the ground, the roads get clear, you know, not sloppy, slushy. But what I hate is like when you get like 2 inches of snow today, 2 inches of snow a couple days from now, an inch of snow, and you know, roads are always sloppy. More salt than snow gets thrown down the roads, and I don't know, that's not fun. But anyway, so I just love fall, love Thanksgiving. Hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving, and hope you enjoy that holiday as much as I do. So I'm going to share this in case anybody, I always throw this stuff out there because if anybody has any, I am, my next little adventure is I'm planning on buying a travel trailer. Not a big one. Don't need anything big. I'm just a weekend warrior, something we could leave on Friday during the fall. And I'm only going to use it in the winter. So I've been doing a lot of research on travel trailers, trying to find a good one, because what I didn't realize is that a lot of travel trailers, you can't use during the winter. They're not made for it. You know, your water lines freeze, or just, you know, you can use them, but you got to, it's just not a super convenient, not a super feasible thing to do. So I started looking at Airstreams. There's an Airstream dealer down in Hales Corners. And I drove by, and, you know, they're kind of cool aluminum exteriors. So I drove by this Airstream dealer. I saw one out front, go on the Airstream website. Their small model is called the Basecamp, the Airstream Basecamp. They got a 16-footer, a 20-footer. I thought, you know, that'd be kind of fun. During the summer, we're on the yacht. Spring, summer, fall, early fall, we're on the yacht. But the rest of the year from, you know, mid-November to mid-March, late March, we hike every Saturday. And we've hiked the entire Ice Age Trail from, like, Whitewater all the way up to Elkhart Lake. And then a couple other sections for that. But now if we want to go hiking somewhere, and then there's all these bridle trails and snowmobile trails and equestrian trails in the Kettle Moraine, we've hiked all those. And yeah, not all of them, but, like, I'm telling you, like, 90% of them we've hiked, probably more than that. And some of them multiple times. So, you know, we're looking for new places, new adventures. But on Saturdays, I get up, I go to the gym. By the time I get down to the gym, take a shower. It's 1 o'clock when we leave. And now some of the places we want to go hiking are like an hour and a half away. So then it's like 2:30 by the time you get to, wherever you want to go hiking. One of the other things that I don't like as much about fall is that time change. I'd be a fan of staying on, I guess it's daylight savings time year round, because I guess right now we're standard time, correct? That drives me nuts. That's the only thing I don't like about fall, is all of a sudden it's dark at 4:30 in the afternoon. So that's the only thing that I'm not a huge fan of in fall, is it'd be nice to stay on standard time, which the sun still goes early. It's amazing. Like, you know, it's 4:30 in the afternoon. It's getting dark out. I mean, the sun goes down at, I think, 4:19 with sunset today. It's dark out, but yet, you think in the summer, you'd have 5 hours of light left. It's amazing how much, but maybe that's another reason why fall just isn't so hustle, so rushed, is because with the shorter days, you just end up with less, you know, packing less into the day, and it just makes it more of a pleasant experience. But that's the only downside for fall. But again, so fall comes, we take the dog hiking. I don't got to worry about forecast for, you know, it's much easier to plan for, less stress thinking about than the summer when I'm got to watch the rain forecast really close for boating and yachting. And but so we've hiked all of these trails within an hour drive, hour and a half drive of where we are here in New Berlin. So, and then we started going to like some of the DNR state natural areas, which are essentially are like the public hunting grounds around, finding those where there's like trails and stuff. And that's been fun, you know, up in, there's an Allenton wildlife area. The DNR has a website where you can go and just find all these public access areas. Some of them are hunting grounds, some of them are not, but they're all state natural areas where it's public grounds. And again, most of them are hunting grounds. Speaking of which, congratulations to all the hunters who had a good season. If anybody, feel free to share, especially in the Wisconsin Carry Facebook group. I love seeing deer pictures from people's hunt. I used to do that in the Facebook group, the fascist book group, but obviously being banned from fascist book, I can't do that. But maybe I should make a post on the MeWe page because I've always enjoyed seeing people's deer harvest this time of year. But so we've hiked all these trails within an hour drive, hour and a half drive of our house. And we want to kind of get out and have some new adventures in a little bit further area. So I was like, you know what? I need to get a little travel trailer. I drove by the Airstream dealership and saw those little base camps. I thought that'd be cool. We could leave on Friday night, drive a couple hours Friday night, get to wherever we want to go. You know, maybe where I go up to like, you know, the Castle Rock Lake area to anyway, just kind of places where that we could hike the Ice Age Trail all across Wisconsin. But we get there Friday night, Saturday morning, I usually do like my cardio and stuff. I could, you know, find a place to, you know, run a hill or something, get my cardio in on Saturday mornings, and then come back to the camper, travel trailer, shower, head out for our afternoon hike. After we get done hiking, this is what we do now. We tailgate. That's the best part of the hike, the tailgate after the hike. Sit there, fire up a heater so my fiance doesn't get cold. We stick it under a table, a little tiny table. I have a welding blanket that I put over it so because that doesn't start on fire. Oh, Scott got a 9-pointer and a doe. Scott, you got to post. You got to make a post on the MeWe page. I want to see them. I'd love to see them. I live vicariously through people when they're with deer hunting. I deer hunted when I was a kid with my stepdad. He got me into it and really enjoyed it. Then high school comes along and basketball season was right during the middle of deer season. And, you know, I was just more interested in sticking around and chasing girls and everything than hunting. So I got away from deer hunting. Still did pheasant hunting for quite a while. I haven't hunted in a couple of years. Used to pheasant hunt with Kim and the kids, but once we got the dog, we ended up just doing more hiking. But anyway, so I live vicariously through other people because I still think deer hunting would be a ton of fun, you know, very, it's such a tradition for people, such a good time with friends. And so whenever I see people deer hunting, I live vicariously through them. But yeah, so we get done hiking, we tailgate. And then, so I'm looking at getting a travel trailer because, like I said, we could leave on Friday, go somewhere Saturday morning. We leave on Friday, drive a couple hours Saturday morning, you know, kind of get up, cook breakfast, do my morning cardio, come back, shower, take a hike. And then after the hike, instead of tailgating behind the truck, we could just, in the travel trailer, play some cards, have some drinks, don't need to drive anywhere, don't need to drive home. Sunday morning, get up, make breakfast, and then come back home, roll the trailer in the garage, which, of course, now these travel trailers. So I was looking at a Airstream base camp, and then I find out that those aren't four-season trailers. There's only a select number of travel trailers that are really made for all four seasons. Most travel trailers, I mean, people like them during the late spring, summer, and early fall. Well, for me, I want to use it the opposite. I want to use it late fall, winter, and early spring. Now, the good thing is that places where I'd want to go, because camping has gotten super popular now that COVID. Camping's gotten super popular. Boating's gotten super popular now that with COVID and the new normal. But camping, I've heard you used to be able to just go from, you know, decide on, you know, one day where you want to go, call the campground. They always had open spots. And now because everybody's camping, it's really hard to find spots. You got to plan way, way far in advance to be able to get a spot. But that would be the opposite for me because I'm going in the winter. There's, you know, some campgrounds aren't year-round campgrounds, but there's a lot of campgrounds that are open in the winter. So I pretty much wouldn't have to worry about finding a slot if you wanted a place with electric. They're all over the state. And so anyway, I started thinking to myself that that could be a really fun winter adventure. Then I start researching travel trailers, realizing that, again, not all travel trailers are made for winter. In fact, very, very few are actually made for winter and would be feasible in the winter. And that's when I found the Oliver trailer. If you go to Oliver Trailers, or Google it, Oliver Trailers, you'll see they make a four-season camper. It's a molded fiberglass, so it's and it's very well insulated, double hull construction, really well insulated. They put the pipes and everything on the inside of the insulated layer so that you got don't have to worry about it freezing up and keep the heat running and you're good. So anyway, that's what I'm looking at. But if anybody's really knowledgeable about the travel trailer stuff, I'm interested in hearing from you. If you're very experienced, shoot me an email, nik@wisconsincarry.org, and we can talk travel trailers. But anyway, so that's what I've been doing lately is researching those, and because that's going to be our next adventure that we do in the late fall, winter, and spring. But yeah, so I need to get my garage made bigger. I hate keeping stuff outside. I don't want to have to winterize the trailer every weekend or every week when I bring it home. So I need to, I've got a 4-car heated garage, but it's only got 8-foot doors. The travel trailer I'm looking at, the Oliver Legacy Elite, it's called, is 9 feet tall. So I need to have, now I'm looking into having my garage header raised so I can put a double 18-by-9-foot door. Is it 18? Sixteen by 9 foot door on the one side of the garage so that I can just come home. Like I said, would I comfortably fit in a travel trailer? Good question. See, I haven't toured one yet. Oliver Trailers, the one I'm looking at, they don't have dealerships. So you can't just go to a dealership and check one out. So the Legacy Elite is their smaller model, but it's the one that, the reason I'm looking at that one is it's 9 feet tall. I think I'd be able to, the other one, their Legacy Elite 2 is a little bit longer, but it's, and it's taller, but it would require 9'6" clearance. And I don't think I'd be able to move the header up of my garage enough to get that in. So comfortably fit in a travel trailer, you know, it's only for overnights, you know, for a Friday night. I don't think I'd enjoy it. And even the yacht, like when we went out on our yacht, like a 4-day weekend on the yacht is really about all you want to do. Cause the below deck area of the yacht isn't super big. I mean, it's got a queen size bed, but it's still, I mean, cramped compared to a, 5,000 square foot house like I live in. So yeah, it's definitely, it's not something I'd want to do for like weeks on end for sure. But I think for, like I said, leave Friday, just, don't need to pack a ton of food or a ton of clothes. Just leave Friday, drive a couple hours, get there. And you got all day Saturday to for us to hike and spend outside and then, play cards, sit and chill inside the trailer. And maybe occasionally we might even use it during the summer. If there's a rainy weekend, we can't take the yacht out. Well, throw the travel trailer in the back of the truck and drive to someplace where it's going to be nice and not raining. So, but I haven't toured one yet. So yeah, when Eben says, would I fit comfortably in one? I don't know. I want to get in one and see, do I feel claustrophobic in there? The one I'm looking at, some of these travel trailers, I mean, you've probably seen them going down the road. They're huge. And then you got the slider sides and it's just, I mean, these things are massive. I don't want anything that big. I want something nice and small, easily trailable. You don't really feel it behind my Super Duty. And, so I'm not looking for one that has like the sliders, the things that crank out and make it a big, huge living area inside of there. Just something small and cozy for me, Kim, and the dog. Maybe one of the kids might occasionally come along with us. So how Oliver Trailer does it is they locate a person in your area and invite them, or they hook you up. They pay them a small stipend for you to go get to tour someone else's trailer. And so that's what they'll be, they're looking for one right now for me so I can go see one. So yeah, that's what their bigger one, the Legacy Elite 2 has 6'6" of headroom in, and I'm 6'2", actually 6'1.5". But, so the headroom in the Legacy Elite, the smaller one, is only 6'1". So I'm like, I just don't know. I don't know how I'm going to feel in it. Is it going to feel claustrophobic? Is it going to feel cozy and comfy? I don't know. So we'll see, but Yeah, and the prices on trailers, those things are up probably 20% with the increased demand. So, and then with the increased demand, lead time is about 10 months. I think if you order right now, you can take delivery in like August. That's what they're scheduling deliveries for. So it would actually work out well for me if I were to order one in the next few weeks. I'd be able to take delivery by next fall, which is when I want to use it, is upcoming in fall. So so I'll keep you guys posted. That's my next little adventure, next little spendy thing that I want to do is get a travel trailer. But so first thing I want to talk about tonight was Kyle Rittenhouse. You all know the verdict. You know what happened. We speculated, you know, what's next for Kyle? Does he become a Joe the Plumber-like celebrity? Does he go speaking at conservative events, that kind of thing? Here was an interesting article. Someone on the Wisconsin Carry MeWe page group posted this, and it said, Kyle Rittenhouse's perilous future. Knowledge is good. And so I'm going to read this because it poses some interesting things. This is George Perry is the author of this. George Perry, P-A-R-R-Y. Hopefully I'm saying that right. Yesterday, this is the article. Yesterday, the American Spectator published my article about the legal peril confronting Kyle Rittenhouse in the aftermath of his acquittal. In it, I recommended that Rittenhouse keep his mouth shut, stay out of the public spotlight, and prepare for legal challenges to come. Nevertheless, he did a lengthy interview with Tucker Carlson, which you can view by clicking on this picture. And then he's got a link to the Tucker Carlson interview. Although he did well under Carlson's sympathetic questioning, for the reasons spelled out below, I stand by my recommendation that he lower his profile and avoid making public statements of any kind. So here's the editorial that George Perry had in the American Spectator. Not guilty on all counts, that was the verdict by a courageous Kenosha, Wisconsin jury in the unwarranted prosecution of Kyle Rittenhouse. It had been obvious from the beginning to non-deranged and fair-minded persons who had viewed the widely broadcast video evidence that Rittenhouse had shot his three assailants in self-defense. The prosecution's decision to charge him with murder and assault was mystifying, at least until we got a look at the bizarre, inept, and straw-grasping performance by the desperate, flop-sweating prosecutors sent into the courtroom to convict Rittenhouse. They appeared to be social justice warriors with law degrees and a tenuous grasp of reality who were on a mission to win at all costs, evidence be damned. Well, speaking as one old prosecutor to a couple of shaved tails, I don't know what that reference is, I hope you boys learned a lesson. Torturing facts and trying to pull fast ones on the defense gets you only so far before reality and common sense take over and bite you in the derriere. Once again, a baseless and largely fictitious media narrative disintegrated when it collided with the facts of the case. Nevertheless, given the threats of violence, if Rittenhouse was acquitted, he was at grave risk of conviction right up until the jury spoke. For now, the young man is free of criminal charges, but legally speaking, where does he go from here? Let's start with the state charges of which he has been acquitted. Some benighted leftist diehards are demanding that the prosecution appeal the jury's verdict, but under our laws, there is no appeal from an acquittal, period. The case is over. But what about double jeopardy? Does the acquittal in state court preclude our woke Justice Department under the fearless leadership of Attorney General Merrick, the hammer of the PTA Garland, from bringing federal charges? It does not. Under our system of dual sovereignties, an acquittal in state court does not bar federal charges arising out of the same facts. For example, when the police were acquitted in state court for beating Rodney King, they were subsequently convicted in federal court for violating his civil rights. Same beating, different courts, different legal results. Will the feds charge Rittenhouse? Unlike the police in the Rodney King case, he was not a state actor and was not acting at the behest of local government. On that basis, there is no clear legal jurisdiction for federal charges. But President Joe Biden has denounced Rittenhouse as a white supremacist, and minutes after the jury found Rittenhouse guilty, House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler tweeted, "This heartbreaking verdict is a miscarriage of justice and sets a dangerous precedent which justifies federal review by DOJ." He added, "Justice cannot tolerate armed persons crossing state lines looking for trouble while people engage in the First Amendment-protected protest." This, God help us, from the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Even worse, Lawrence Tribe, a professor of constitutional law at Harvard, followed up Nadler's tweet with one of his own. "I join Chairman Nadler in that respect. The idea that other vigilantes could take it upon themselves to shoot innocent people to death the way Rittenhouse did and get away scot-free is incompatible with the survival of a civilized, law-based society. Similarly, Representative Sean Maloney, Democrat from New York, chairman of the Democrat Congressional Campaign Committee, opened his public statements with this: "It's disgusting and disturbing that someone was able to carry a loaded assault rifle into a protest against the unjust shooting of Jacob Blake, a black man, and take the lives of two people and injure another and face absolutely no consequences." Now, just to say, unjust shooting of Jacob Blake, that was deemed by a black liberal former police chief from Madison, Noble Ray, as justified. So they keep pushing this unjust shooting of Jacob Blake, but yet it was deemed justified by the lengthy investigation that took place. So back to the editorial. "Now I'm going to go through the tedium of explaining point by point how these proclamations are untethered to the facts. Suffice it to say that those who have obtained and continue to seek political benefit from the false Rittenhouse as a vigilante narrative peddled by CNN, MSNBC, and the legacy media are not about to stop. They will ride that hobby horse until it is no longer in their interest to do so. So it is that Rittenhouse remains at severe risk of being criminally charged by the woke social justice warriors who run the Department of Justice. After all, an agency that will willfully and intentionally cease enforcing the law at our southern border in order to admit what it hopes will be a tidal wave of future Democrat voters while simultaneously targeting as domestic terrorists parents who are fighting the state for control of their children's fate is capable of anything, no matter how illegal. Or to paraphrase, the bandit leader in the treasure of the Sierra Madre, the Justice Department, social justice warriors don't need no stinking jurisdiction. They will do whatever they want. And of course, in addition to that, Rittenhouse faces the certainty of civil litigation. The parents of Anthony Huber, who was killed by Rittenhouse, have issued the following statement. There was no justice for Anthony or for Mr. Rittenhouse's other victims, Joseph Rosenbaum and Gage Grosskreutz. Today's verdict means there is no accountability for the person who murdered our son. It sends the unacceptable message that armed civilians can show up in any town, incite violence, and then use the danger they have created to justify shooting people in the street. Neither Mr. Rittenhouse nor the Kenosha police who authorized his bloody campaign will escape justice. Anthony will have his day in court. The Kenosha police deny that they authorized armed civilians, including Rittenhouse, to help during the riots. So why are Huber's parents claiming otherwise? Most likely it's because young Mr. Rittenhouse has no assets and is judgment-proof. But if he was acting under the authority of the police, then the city of Kenosha can be held liable for damages. Oh, and by the way, the mere claim that police could have authorized his actions may be enough of a pretext for the woke Justice Department to investigate Rittenhouse as a state actor who violated the civil rights of Huber, Rosenbaum, and Grosskreutz. In short, the drumbeat continues that Rittenhouse faces a perilous future as every progressive's favorite legal pinata. As for television commentators who insist that he should start suing the media for defamation, my advice is quite to the contrary. Rittenhouse should forget about suing anybody. Stop trying to explain why he did what he did. Stay out of the public eye, keep his mouth shut, and brace for the onslaught. In a later article, I will explain why a defamation suit by Rittenhouse is a really bad idea. Okay, so that's George Perry. I don't know George Perry, never heard the name before. But I wanted to comment on this because I disagree. I think that when it comes to Kyle Rittenhouse, civil suits coming, perhaps, and civil suits from Anthony Huber's parents, I mean, perhaps. But Kyle Rittenhouse so clearly acted in self-defense. I don't doubt that there's a rogue attorney who would take Anthony Huber's parents' case pro bono. But that said, look at what, you know, the Castle Doctrine isn't in play here because Rittenhouse wasn't in his home, his vehicle, or his place of business. So Castle Doctrine provides some insulation from civil litigation. So Kyle Rittenhouse doesn't have that protection over him. But let's not forget that a civil case is still a jury trial. And to find 12 jurors who think that Anthony Huber, who assaulted Kyle Rittenhouse with a skateboard to the head, I mean, I just don't think that's a strong case at all. So would, may it be filed? Perhaps. Do I think it has any chance of success? No, I don't. And I also think that the best defense is a good offense. For Kyle to sit back and lay low, I just think is the wrong thing to do. I would go on the offense if I was Kyle, suing the people that slandered him, that libeled him, calling him a white supremacist. I say this from the perspective that obviously sometimes with these cases, we get more wrapped up in like the greater picture, the bigger picture, the implications for other people. Where, like, example, when Wisconsin Kerry takes a case for someone, I'm looking to set precedent. And that sometimes, so when we take a case for someone, that's why we generally don't do criminal defense, because if we were to do criminal defense, then someone offers, you know, Wisconsin Kerry would take the case, not because we're a legal defense fund, but because we would want to set precedent. Well, if a plea bargain is made and someone is charged with, you know, unlawfully carrying a gun or something, and we take the case, and then we want the precedent that the way that they were carrying was lawful and legal, and then they're offered a plea bargain to take maybe some kind of felony charge down to a misdemeanor with a minimal fine. Well, that would be in the defendant's take that plea bargain, perhaps, where Wisconsin Kerry's best interest would be, we want to fight this through and get some legal precedent set. So you can see how, as I think about the Kyle Rittenhouse case, I have to think about it from the perspective of not just what's best for the movement, what's best for freedom, what's best for the bigger picture, but I got to put myself in Kyle's shoes and say, what's best for Kyle? With that said, I think that civil lawsuits, and I've heard from his comments to Tucker Carlson that he's got attorneys who are going to be working on that. I mean, I think civil lawsuits are a wise idea. Kyle has had his anonymity ripped away by this case and the national attention that it's garnered. And this prosecution, and look, this was the facts of this case were so strong for Kyle that it really made the prosecutor had to resort to some really underhanded, dirty tactics. It didn't make the prosecutor look good. It didn't make the Kenosha DA's office look good. It didn't make anybody look good down there. And so do think that on the criminal side that the Department of Justice wants to take this case? I don't think the Department of Justice wants to touch this case with a 10-foot pole. I don't think that they think that it would be, I mean, they can sit there and they can play the media, oh, terrible, this is awful card and try to pander to their Democrat base in the media or in the general public as much as they want. But the facts of the case aren't going to be any better for a federal case. You know, the facts of the case aren't going to be any better if the feds put him on trial. The facts don't change. The videos don't change. So I just don't think that anybody at the DOJ would want to take on a loser of a case. So from the criminal side, from the Department of Justice, I have one worry, and I even hesitate to say this, but I'm just going to say it because I don't think the Department of Justice listens to Well on Radio, but I have been concerned from the start that Kyle Rittenhouse was going to get charged with violating the gun-free school zone statute. That's my worry. Now, do I want to go into detail about why not really. I mean, I don't want to lay out, but there was a high school like a block away, well within 1,000 feet from where Rittenhouse used his firearm. Not being able to be 21, Kyle wasn't able to obtain a concealed carry permit, so there's no way for him to exempt himself from gun-free school zones. With everything they tried to throw at him, I'm kind of shocked that the DA didn't throw the gun-free school zone charge at him. I mean, to me, it seems like a sure conviction. The only way to exempt yourself from the gun-free school zones is to have a concealed carry permit, which he wasn't legally allowed to have. Perhaps this is something I don't know, perhaps the privilege of self-defense would excuse him from, you know, I don't know the law well enough, because I know that, like, for example, the charge that he faced of endangering McGinnis, the photographer slash journalist from the Daily Caller, I remember in the judge's instructions, if he was justified in using self-defense against Rosenbaum, then the fact that he had endangered McGinnis's safety was excused by the privilege of self-defense. So I don't know if, because Kyle uses gun in self-defense, if that somehow negates the gun-free school zone statute. I don't know the answer to that question. But that was been my concern all along, is that for everything they tried to throw at Kyle, that seems like a glaring one. I'm glad they didn't. Maybe there's a reason. Maybe there's a legal reason they didn't. But that would be another thing. See, Wisconsin has a gun-free school zone statute, and the feds have a gun-free school zone statute. That's my concern. So all that said, in terms of any kind of, you know, murder charges or something, the facts of the case didn't fit that in the state court. Certainly isn't going to fit it in federal court. And I think it would be a political loser. I think the left knows that it's a political loser to continue to try to persecute Kyle Rittenhouse. He's a nice young kid, looks like a, you know, with his little baby face and such. It just, I don't think that from the political standpoint, there's anything. I don't think that the Department of Justice would want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. So civil suits coming perhaps, but I don't see those being efficacious. So I don't understand why this George Perry guy has any, and again, he's going to explain why a defamation suit by Rittenhouse is a really bad idea in some future article. I'll kind of keep my eyes peeled for that. But I think the best, certainly for the movement, is to play offense. And I think even for Kyle himself, the best, if you want to keep people from coming after you, make an example out of a couple people who've already come after Kyle. Make an example out of the TV stations that call them white supremacists. Make an example out of Gwen Moore for tweeting that he was a white supremacist. Make an example out of, you know, I don't know if you can sue us. I mean, assuming you can sue a sitting president, Joe Biden, they called him a white supremacist. You know, these are all cases that I think the best defense is a good offense. And if Kyle starts going after people, if you want to stop people from calling you a white supremacist, sue a couple people and get a settlement out of them, and other people are going to stop calling you a white supremacist. So in this editorial, I don't think that George Perry, aside from expressing an opinion, has made any logical hook, any logical platform to justify Kyle Rittenhouse laying low. I think Kyle should, well, certainly Kyle should do what he wants to do. If Kyle so desires, and with that said, I was kind of, you know, Kyle during an interview with Tucker Carlson said, you know, well, I support Black Lives Matter. Didn't really explain what he meant there. Didn't explain if he, you know, I don't know if Kyle really knows what the, well, and they say, look, if you're 20, you're not a conservative, excuse me, if you're 20, you're not a liberal, you don't have a heart. If you're 30, you're not a conservative, you don't have a brain. Kyle's 18 years old. Does he strike me as a really political person? No. He just struck me as someone who was, you know, definitely into guns at his near adult age, more so than someone that was into politics. And you know, Kyle doesn't strike me as some young conservative, what's the word for some up and coming young conservative, some young conservative, some passionate young conservative. I just think he was a kid that was into guns, you know, but maybe it's from just, you know, playing video games you know, kids like that first person shooter, experience. Again, not saying that has anything to do with him using his gun and protecting himself while he's protecting businesses, but So I don't know that Kyle wants to or really is in the of the mindset to be a political speaker. I don't know. Obviously, he could speak to self-defense, but is Kyle Rittenhouse a big Second Amendment advocate? You know, does he understand on that philosophical constitutional level? I don't know. So it's he'll do what he wants to do, but I see no reason for him to lay low and hide. Let people take shots at you. I mean, people have been taking shots at him for the last year. I think if he wants to end some of that, it's time to take a couple shots back. And I think that would be the smartest thing for him to do. Next thing I was going to talk about tonight was the Ahmaud Arbery case. This is an interesting one because the Ahmaud Arbery case, when this was first posted, in fact, I don't think I was yet banned from Fascist Book when the Ahmaud Arbery shooting was first posted. And so there was two things that made me think about this. One, just the verdict coming in, but then yesterday, or maybe it was Friday night, on 2020, or it was some one of those Dateline-like shows, one of those news magazine-like TV shows on the network. It was either ABC or NBC or Fox. It was either ABC or NBC. Excuse me. It was either ABC or NBC. I'm pretty sure it wasn't Fox. But they had a special the other night about the Ahmaud Arbery case. And it starts off with one of Ahmaud's relatives, and he's out jogging. And the relative says, yeah, when I go jogging, it makes me feel like a connection to Ahmaud, because that's how Ahmaud has been portrayed. Ahmaud was portrayed in the media as a jogger who was chased down and gunned down by some vigilante white boys down in Georgia. Now, tell you, the narrative hasn't been that Ahmaud Arbery was had a long criminal history, that Ahmaud Arbery was caught on video casing a home under construction. It's amazing how the left makes martyrs out of terrible people. George Floyd was not a good guy. He was not a good guy. He was had a semi-violent past. You know, he probably all heard this. He held a gun to some woman, pregnant woman's belly or something. He had the drug problems. He's had previous run-ins with the law. He wasn't a great guy. Jacob Blake. Not a great guy. Jacob Blake sexually assaulted his ex-girlfriend. For those who don't know the story, Jacob Blake, I don't know if he broke in his ex, barged into his ex-girlfriend's house, shoved his finger up her vagina, pulled it out, smelled it, and said, "Smells like you've been with other men." And for that, his ex-girlfriend filed a police report. Jacob Blake was charged with assault, and she was given a restraining order against him. Jacob Blake was violating that restraining order when the police were called by the girlfriend who he had assaulted, sexually assaulted. The police came. Jacob Blake resisted arrest. They tased him. He pulled the tasers, prongs out, got up, pulled a knife, which is why the officers didn't want to go hand-to-hand with him, and then proceeded to try to steal his ex-girlfriend's car with their mutual kids in it that he was prohibited from having contact with. So he was in the process of kidnapping his own kids. Not a good guy. That's Jacob Blake. Ahmaud Arbery, not a good guy. He's got a long criminal record. He was doing illegal things the day that he was chased by these guys in the neighborhood. But with that said, when I saw the video initially that was posted, again, I think it was on the Wisconsin Carry Facebook group, right after this happened down in Georgia, the first thing I said was, this looks like trouble for the defendants down there. This looks like you don't go pursuing someone armed. Now, I also said that in Georgia, they have a citizen's arrest law, and I don't know Georgia law very well. So I couldn't say, I didn't want to predict what the outcome of the case would be or whether they were or weren't guilty. But I can say that here, as we teach the concealed carry class in Wisconsin, we teach use of deadly force in Wisconsin. We would never advise someone to do what those three guys down there did. You don't grab a gun and jump in a car and go chasing someone down who committed a property crime and wasn't a threat to anybody at that moment. The four conditions that justify the use of deadly force: one, be innocent of instigation; two, retreat if possible; three, only use deadly force if no lesser force will do; and four, grave danger, great bodily harm must be imminent. These three guys were completely safe. They jumped in their truck, and I don't even have a problem with trying to stop someone who's committing a crime in your neighborhood. But when you grab a gun and go to do it, and it's not just like a holstered gun, but when you grab a gun and you jump in a pickup truck and you're heading out, that's not innocent of instigation. That's putting yourself in harm's way. If you want to stop someone's, because you can use force to defend property, you just can't use deadly force to protect property. So if they wanted to go running after, chasing after Ahmaud Arbery because he was inside of a home under construction looking for things to steal, supposedly, I mean, there's video of him, and that's what they presume he was doing. He was trespassing. He wasn't allowed to be there. But if they want to go chase after him to detain him, arming themselves to do it and chasing him down is a really bad idea, because from, truthfully, Ahmaud Arbery's perspective, he's running down the street away from the house that he had just been trespassing inside of. But he's fleeing the scene. He's not chasing after these guys. Like in the Rittenhouse case, the guy's chasing after Kyle. So when people are chasing after him and then they've got guns pointed at him, you could perceive that as a threat. And you would want to act to, you know, you don't know that these people know the law on use of deadly force or not. And you know, so the Ahmaud Arbery case was troubling from a use of force standpoint from the beginning, because we would never, how we teach use of deadly force in the Wisconsin carry, concealed carry classes, we would never advocate that people go arm themselves and go chasing after a fleeing perpetrator of a property crime. Look, if you want to follow them, fine. Call 911, fine. Even if you were to choose to try to detain Ahmaud Arbery, which I think is, that's not something I would be trying to do. I mean, if Ahmaud Arbery had stolen something from the house, what would you call things you steal? Is that contraband? Or if he had property, stolen property on him, okay, I mean, I wouldn't let someone run away with my stolen property. I would go try to stop them, but not with my gun. And even going to chase after Ahmaud Arbery armed, like let's say you just have it in a holster, going to get in a physical altercation with someone while you have a holstered gun, that's high risk. They could grab your gun. You know, it's a high risk thing. So if these guys had chased after Ahmaud Arbery and maybe they were armed, maybe they had a gun in the vehicle, or maybe the guy in the truck was armed, but the guy who made contact with Ahmaud Arbery, if he was trying to stop him because he was committing a property crime of trespass or stealing materials from a construction site or something, it was a bad choice to go out and do it armed. And look what happened. So I don't find the verdict in the Ahmaud Arbery case troubling. I find it plausible that makes the most sense in this case. Was Ahmaud Arbery a great guy? No. Did these guys that chased him down, and it's a fair statement, they did chase him down, and supposedly were they trying to make some citizen's arrest as per Georgia law? I don't know the citizen's arrest law in Georgia. I don't remember hearing the jury. I didn't follow that case close enough to hear like the jury instructions and things like that. But this is one where I would never recommend that anybody do what those guys did. If you witness someone, there's a house down the street from me under construction. If I saw someone in there that wasn't supposed to be there, and for whatever reason I knew that, and they start running away, I've seen the owners, I haven't met them, but I've seen the owners going in and out of this house that's under construction. I know what they look like. If I saw someone else, a young kid or you know, younger kid who I knew wasn't supposed to be there, had a high confidence, wasn't supposed to be there, come running out of there. If he didn't have anything in his hands, like he hadn't stolen anything or appeared stealing, I'd call 911, try to follow him in the car, certainly. Would I try to detain him? No. It's just not worth it. It's not worth it. Would I legally be allowed to detain him? I don't even know that law very well in Wisconsin. Now, if he's running away with some property, that would increase my desire to perhaps want to stop him to prevent the theft of that property. But I'm certainly not going out there with my gun to do it, because that's just escalating a situation that, and putting me in a position that I don't want to be in. And so, so I don't worry about the bad precedent set. If the precedent set from the Ahmaud Arbery cases, when someone commits a property crime and runs away, that you either have to follow them, be a good witness for the police, you know, track them, but that pulling your gun and trying to stop him isn't allowed or is going to result in charges, I'm okay with that precedent. I'm okay if people say, you know, when I see someone running out of a store, if I see someone running out of a Home Depot with arms full of merchandise, I'm not concerned that the precedent has been set that me pulling my gun and chasing after them and then ending up getting an altercation, having to shoot them, would expose me to charges of murder. Because if I see someone running out of Home Depot with arms full of merchandise and maybe the, you know, I don't even know if the security guards chase after people anymore. Maybe they're advised not to do that by their corporate legal counsel. But if I see someone, you know, we've seen them on TV, some guy ransacking a CVS down in San Francisco or whatever. Some people, I think they did it. I don't know if they did it at the Nike outlet store in Pleasant Prairie or some other places, but I think the outlet stores in Pleasant Prairie had been, had a bunch of kids go in there, a bunch of young people go in there and some not so young go in there and ransack the place and start looting it and stealing while the store was open, clerks were there. If I saw someone running out of a store like that, do I want, do I think that pulling out your gun and chasing them down is something that we need to be emboldened and able to do? No, I don't think that. If someone were to want to chase, do I think, yeah, here even says, or even Mayfair Mall. If I saw someone committing retail theft, would I step in? That's another difficult one, because some of these stores, if the store themselves isn't going to chase after someone stealing from the store, why the hell should I? Why the hell should I put myself in any kind of legal peril for a store that's not going to act in their own, that's not going to act to protect their own merchandise? So let me use a different example. If I saw someone, my neighbors, I know who my neighbors are. If I saw a car pull up and a bunch of thugs jump out of the car, smash the front door, run inside, start grabbing stuff, would I go try to stop them from doing that? Yes, I would. Would I grab my gun and go try to do it? No, I would not. If I would make that, would I holster a gun under a shirt, you know, concealed? Maybe. But I got to think, if you see, you know, it's just, if you see someone, because again, the paradigm would be you go to stop them from stealing your neighbor's stuff. Then they pull out a gun and then you're not armed. And then all of a sudden you're in a position where you can't defend yourself. I think that's where you have to make that choice. If you're going to get involved, in a physical altercation to stop someone from stealing property, you almost have to make that choice to take the risk that they may end up being, well, and look, I'm a big guy. I mean, I'm a bodybuilder. I'm stronger than 99% of the people out there. So being engaged in a physical altercation with someone doesn't concern me if I'm trying to stop someone stealing from my neighbor's house. But going out there armed, I just don't know if that's worth it. And I hate seeing, you know, evil prevails when good men do nothing. And I hate seeing that. But do I think that if I saw someone trying to steal my neighbor's car, would I go and try to stop it? Yes, I would. Would I grab my gun and go try to stop it? That's a tough one. I certainly wouldn't run out there with a gun in my hand. Too many unknowns there. You're running out with a gun in your hand towards your neighbor's house, telling someone to stop. They could perceive that as a threat. You think that it's someone stealing the car? How do you know? Maybe they told their friend to come get the car. And maybe your neighbors locked the keys in the car and they called their friend to try to come over and jimmy the door open. You know, just so many variables. If I was, around my house, I don't conceal carry. I have guns accessible at my house. So again, I'm being very particular thinking about my own specific circumstances, but it's just a touchy thing. You can use force to defend property. You can't use deadly force to protect property. I recommend always being armed, but if you're going to go to try to use non-deadly force to protect property, when you're armed, that is an armed confrontation. It just is. On your own property, you've got castle doctrine to give you some level of protection. Of course, some might make the argument in the home versus in the driveway, the curtilage of your house. Where is castle doctrine going to be extended to? We don't know. Has to be litigated. Certainly inside your house, castle doctrine applies. But I'm not one of these people who says, oh, it's just property. You know, letting people get away with retail theft. And when I say retail, I'm just talking not just from a store, but like if we're supposed to sit by and watch someone break into our neighbor's house and not do anything, I have a problem with that on a philosophical level. But then what do? Do you go over there armed to try to stop it, to try to stop a property crime? Again, if you're carrying and you're concealed, I would say more likely that I would do that. But I don't conceal around my house, so I'd have to be running outside, just grabbing a gun. Then I've got a gun in my hand, and that's presents a different scenario to these thieves at my neighbor's house. And that presents a scenario that I think is a little more risky for me. So I think the choice would be at that point to run out there unarmed and run the risk that they could pull a knife, they could whatever, they could pull a gun, and then I'm not armed. And again, had I been concealed carrying around my house, less of a problem to go out there armed because you're not presenting as an armed person. Anyway, what's your guys' thoughts? I'm not one of these people that says, oh, it's just property, let your insurance cover it, blah, 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 call the police, make a good witness, whatever. I don't like, from a matter of principle, standing back and seeing people do nothing when crime is occurring right in front of their face. I think that just enables and emboldens more crime. But I'm also an advocate of staying out of jail and not getting into an armed confrontation unnecessarily. So when you make that choice to go try to stop a property crime, if you're concealed, I think less of a concern because you're not presenting yourself as an armed, I don't want to say attacker, but you're not presenting yourself armed to that person and escalating the situation, perhaps causing them to fear for their life. And not even in a sense that, look, if someone Here Eben says, it's complicated. I will defend, but jail isn't for me. Yeah, that's jail isn't for me either. I'm with you. Not only is jail not for me, but court is not for me. Like, I don't want to. I hate standing back. I think that's for me. I think that's the choice. I think the choice for me is if I see my neighbor's house, look, retail theft, look, if the store is not going to act in their own to protect their own retail merchandise, I'm an idiot if I put myself in jeopardy to protect a store's retail merchandise. My neighbor's property, different calculus for me. I'm more interested in acting to want to protect my neighbor's property. Then I would have to make that judgment if these people are unarmed. And again, unarmed isn't, you hear people on, even if it isn't a basketball court, I'm not there. Even if people are unarmed, doesn't mean they're not a threat. Doesn't mean they can't become armed, because you can pick up a brick. You can pick up a rake, a stick, a shovel, anything, and suddenly you're armed. But I think that's the choice that for me, I would have to make is if I'm going to go engage with someone stealing property from my neighbor's house and I'm not currently concealed to where I could go take that situation intending to do it with purely hand-to-hand force. I don't think grabbing a gun and having a gun in your hand running over there presents as a very good scenario. But that's the thing in this case, these guys could have followed him out of Arbery, been on the phone with the police, given a good description, followed him wherever they wanted to go, followed him out wherever he was going, run after him. If he starts cutting across lawns, run after him. But running after him with guns, it's a bad idea. It presents bad. It escalates. It creates an armed conflict where one previously might not have existed. And sure, Ahmad could have had a gun, could have had a knife, could have all those things. But I think that's kind of the calculus you have to undertake when you go running to danger, when you go running to chase someone down. Kyle Rittenhouse was running away from danger. Kyle Rittenhouse was not chasing after anybody. Those Gage Grosskreutz and Anthony Huber, even if they thought they were stopping a mass shooter, which they weren't, that's their fault for their misinterpretation of the situation. And that's the way we teach in the concealed carry class. If you misinterpret a situation, you're the one that could be going to jail. This is what we, in the concealed carry class, the example we use. If you're walking down a street and you look down a dark alley and you see a man in a suit and then a man in scruffy clothes that looks like a bum, and the man in scruffy clothes looks like a bum is pointing his gun at the man in the suit, do you act in defense of others to protect the man in the suit? And then the scenario that we use in the concealed carry class is that guy in the suit could be a drug dealer and the guy in the scruffy clothes could be an undercover cop. You just don't know. So that's that risk of inserting yourself in a situation where you don't know everything that's going on. If you were to shoot the guy who presented as a scruffy looking bum pointing a gun at a well-dressed businessman, you're in legal jeopardy. So for Gage Grosskreutz and for Anthony Huber to attack Kyle Rittenhouse, even if they thought that they were doing something noble, they weren't. That was their mistake. They were the ones at fault there. So last thing I got tonight is I was going to hit the mailbag. My conclusion on the Ahmaud Arbery thing, when I first saw it happen, I don't know citizens arrest law in Georgia. Clearly, because they were convicted, the citizens arrest law didn't protect them. They made a bad choice. When I saw it, the initial time I saw the video, I said that was a bad choice to run after them and insert themselves in that situation armed, and that I would never and we would never be. That's an example of what not to do, what those guys did down in Georgia is an example of what not to do when you're armed. Last thing here, listener mailbag. Here's a question that someone posed to me, and this was, again, this is like 3 weeks old. So on one of my previous shows, I was talking about tax breaks and the economy and things like that. Here's a question. This is about tax breaks and being offered to businesses and incentives. Would it still be a bad idea if tax breaks were offered to every business for every job? I heard that there are tax breaks for CEOs of big corporations. So is it better for business to pay billions of dollars to the CEO instead of raising wages or salary for other employees? And the way some companies have failed, one guy gets a nice lined pocket while hundreds lose their job. So I thought maybe companies should be rewarded instead for every job they create. In the family, we have dependents. More dependents, more money you get to keep. Each employee would be like the company's dependents. Now, of course, there are also certain taxes which should be unnecessary. That would be another topic. And while I see the way this plan could be exploited, there are some details that would have to be put in place. Seems fairer for everyone and could make it easier for small businesses knowing that they get help for creating jobs. Let me know what you think. So here's my thing. When it comes to these, you know, tax breaks for businesses and to incentivize companies for hiring, profit is the incentive for companies to do whatever they do, whether it's hire, whether it's, but here's the thing, this notion, because this is what the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation does, is they tax credits for job creation. This is the biggest corporate welfare scam in the history of Wisconsin, this Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Businesses already get a tax break for every job. Example, I pay my employees. Everything that I pay my employees is an expense, and it reduces my taxable income. So if I hire someone and I pay them $50,000, I write off that $50,000 of expenses for my employees' pay. It reduces my taxable income. But the problem is that a tax break targeted to job creation is picking winners and losers. Anybody who's listened to the show has heard me on prior shows rail on tax breaks for job creation for big companies because it disadvantages small companies. When big companies like Generac can go to the state and say, hey, if we stay in Wisconsin, we're going to create this many jobs, we're going to build a new factory and create this many jobs, and then Wisconsin says, okay, here's a $30 million tax credit, and it's tied to job creation. So if you don't create 700 new jobs, you don't get it. But essentially for every job, so then I do the math and I say, okay, 700 jobs divided by 26 million. And the cost, as I do these, the cost often comes out to be between $20,000 and $50,000 per job for these tax incentives. Well, of course, that's for big companies. So what the question that was posed to me here is, okay, so I don't like tax credits just for big companies for job creation, because here's how it disadvantages a small company like me. I'm not big enough to be able to go to the state and say, hey, can I get a tax credit for creating a job? I don't have that kind of pull. But I go to the same career fairs that Generac goes to, and I'm looking to hire engineers, and Generac's looking to hire engineers. But Generac knows that for every engineer they hire, they get a $20,000 or $50,000 tax credit. Well, that puts – Generac can then choose to pay – a person more, they're at a career fair, they can offer someone a higher starting pay because they know that they're going to get a $20,000 tax write-off for hiring that person. I'm trying to hire the same person, but I'm not competing against Generac in the market of generators, but I'm competing against Generac in the market of employment. And then Generac can hire and pay people more because they're getting $20,000 every person they hire. They know they get a $20,000 tax credit from the state. That's picking winners and losers. So, of course, the next thing was, okay, well, then should every business get a tax credit for every person they hire? And my answer would be no. You already do get a tax break for every job you create because you can write off that expense. But a tax break for employees is an interference with the free market ecosystem. What if I want to grow my company with a new piece of equipment? I want to be more efficient and I want to automate. I want to install a robot that will replace three workers. Oh, terrible, you say. Well, no, that's efficiency, and we need efficient markets. Efficiency and productivity allows more production with less input, and that lowers costs and it raises everybody's standard of living. We get nicer stuff cheaper, and the labor capital demand opens up in areas where it's most productive and more efficient. i.e. we'd rather have people building robots instead of people picking boxes off a conveyor belt. So it's not that you just want to create a job. This notion that, oh, we just want to create a job, just incentivize companies for creating a job. No, the free market will dictate what jobs should be created, and profit is all the incentive you need for that. The free market will also dictate what job shouldn't be created, because it would be better to be perhaps automated. And that labor, the human capital of labor, would be better devoted to, again, producing the robot instead of picking a box off of a conveyor belt and putting it on a pallet. Now, we currently have a labor shortage in this country, so we don't even need to create more jobs. We have more jobs than we can fill. We don't need to incentivize job creation. We should let the free market work. The free market will allocate resources better than any government policy ever could. So now, I'm in favor of an across-the-board tax cut, which is always better than a targeted tax cut. Allow businesses to keep more of their money and then individually decide how they can best use it. So this notion that there's like these targeted tax cuts that are going to be, no, I just, some businesses would be better off automating. They'd be better off spending money on equipment. They say, oh, well, I wanted to put in an automated conveyor system, an automated pick pack system, instead of hiring a bunch of people. But this guy across town, he just hired people to do the work and he gets a big tax credit. And then some people might say, well, that's good because they create a job. No, the epiphany, the end result isn't let's just create a job at all costs. The end result should be let's make sure that labor capital is most efficiently devoted to the best places for it. We don't want to incentivize someone to hire a bunch of people to do tasks that could be automated. We would rather incentivize the automation, or it's better for the automation. The free market will decide if it's better for automation than to hire people. And then the jobs open up at the plant that makes the robots instead of the warehouse that wants to pay people to pick boxes off a conveyor belt and put them on a pallet. But here's another example. You know, people say, oh, well, tax, you know, we want to encourage people saving for retirement. So tax exempting retirement money is good, right? I mean, we allow people to save their money tax-free. And it's for retirement, right? I mean, that's noble. That's altruistic, right? And I would say not necessarily. See, this notion that the government is doing you a favor by letting you save for retirement tax-free, that's, again, just picking winners and losers and not letting the free market decide what's best. The average rate of return on invested retirement money is about 7% historically. You throw money in the market, you get about 7% on it. So when you put money into your retirement plan, who gets that money? Wall Street does. You know, your 401k, that's invested in stocks and bonds and mutual funds. And so Wall Street gets that money, and Wall Street allocates it to different companies, banks, oil companies, lumber companies, car companies, restaurant companies. It's invested in the industries that Wall Street thinks will do the best with the investment. But Wall Street isn't making 7% on your money. The average rate of return, you know, people that just shuffle their money into their retirement account, look back over 50, even look back over history, last 100 years, the average rate of return is 7%, 7.5%, something like that. But Wall Street, who has all that money that you put in, that you were incentivized, oh, you put it in because it's tax-free, Wall Street isn't happy making 7% on that money. Wall Street's making more. Every company Wall Street invests in, they're not happy making a 7% return on investment. They want much larger returns, and they get much larger returns. So do you know how many businesses are happy with a 7% return on investment? Very, very few. Most real estate investors want at least 15% return on investment. I own rental property, and my return on investment is more like 15%. Kind of hard to calculate because I don't know for sure what the value of my rental property is, so I'm kind of guessing at the retail market value. But the cash flow on my rental property is about 11% return on investment every year. And plus the house appreciates in value every year, usually. So if the value of a house goes up 5% per year, you can add that to your real return realize upon the sale of the asset, of course, you'd realize that. So it's more like 16%. So my 16% that I earn on my rental property, that's more than double the 7% that people get when they shuffle their money into their retirement funds. The money that I spent on my rental property, that wasn't tax-free. So you're not calculating the tax savings. But here's my point. My point is, there are far better places for people to invest their money. Why do people who shove their money into retirement funds thinking that, oh, I'm getting the tax savings? Those people, if they weren't given the tax incentive, they may say, hey, I'm going to take this money and buy real estate. I'm going to take this money and buy a small business. I'm going to take this money. And there's so many other ways that money could perhaps be invested. But the government incentivizing people, it's the same thing when government allowed people to write off mortgage interest. That's just encouraged. That was just a big handout to the banks, because then people take out big mortgages. Oh, well, I can write off the mortgage interest. The government dabbling in the free market is never a good idea. My return on investment of starting my own company was astronomical. I mean, I spent about $50,000 starting my own company. I mean, and it returns me astronomically more than that. So what's my point? You know, tax cuts to encourage people to put their money into the stock market sacrifices the potential to put their money into other things. So why does a person get tax savings for giving their money to Wall Street to make billions on, instead of investing in something else like rental property, like starting a business, like investing directly in someone else's business, not a publicly traded company? So some people might choose to invest in mutual funds in their 401k, but others might say, you know, I'd rather buy a rental unit. I'd rather start a restaurant. But they have to do that with after-tax money. So see, this is why I'm not a fan of these targeted tax breaks. Some people might say, oh, well, then let's give people a tax cut for investing in, you know, a business or something. Well, again, this is why I'm a fan of the flat tax and spending limits on government. Because taxes should be as low as they could possibly be. And then everybody just pays the same flat tax. And again, I'm in favor of limiting government spending so that we can have that flat tax be as low as possible. But let the free market decide where people invest their money. Do they want to invest it in stocks and bonds? Or do they want to invest it in rental property that might give them a much, much greater return? Does a business that wants to hire someone, do they want to invest in hiring more people because they get a tax credit for that? Or do they want to invest in automation? Automation might be the best thing for their business. But, oh, then you got to consider, well, but I get this tax break if I hire someone, so should I automate or should I not? The best thing for the most efficient use of resources is to get government out of the business of trying to incentivize one thing over the other and just let the free market decide. Keep taxes as low as possible, flat tax. Everybody pays the same 15% or whatever, and then do everything we can to limit government spending so that we can make the best use of the resources that we have. So anyway, my little reminder here is telling me that my live feed is going to end. I was only going to put in an hour for the show tonight, and I put in 90 minutes instead. And it's a good thing I put in an hour, because I went well over my hour, and I'm actually running up against my 90-minute limit for the podcast here. So thank you guys for tuning in. Thanks, Scott and Eben and Lon and Ralph from Pleasant Prairie popping here at the latter part or mid part of the show. So great to have you guys all in. Hope you guys have a great week. Hope you guys enjoy your Cyber Monday tomorrow. That's kind of probably an old thing. People just do their cyber shopping all the time now and from home and whatever. But anyway, hope you guys had a great Thanksgiving. And we're now into the Christmas holiday season. Hope you're season is going well, and we will talk to you guys next week. Have a great week. Carry on and be well armed.
Chick Julie. You've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.